I hope nobody's told you they love you this morning.
If you're not going.
Thanks for that glowing introduction, Wes. The last time I was introduced, this little lady got up and said, tall, dark, handsome, and talks funny, and I kept sitting waiting for Harry Belafonte to come up. You know? So, if you remember, the three workshops ago, I think, I was on Saturday night at 8 p.m., that's primetime TV, and then the next one they moved me to Sunday morning at 9, and that's televangelist time, and so this time they got me on Saturday morning with the Looney Tunes. Maybe it'll work out here. For those of you who, the untrained eye will not recognize me readily as a miracle, but I assure you I am. And to share with you where I came from and who I was and what I was when I got here is very essential to letting you know who I am and what I am today. And with that, I have to start at the beginning. And I would like to say, with the 30-minute thing, Jimmy Smith and Bill Root talk a lot faster than I do, so I'm going to take more time. I figure if old Root has lasted this long, he can make it to 10:30. But I was born in 1947, and one of the baby boomers, and I was the 10th child in my family, 7th son, 10th child, and I was not a pleasant surprise. No one but my mother knew I was on the way. She was 47 years old, had already had 9 children, and my father had lost his sight 2 years earlier, and the last thing they needed was another baby. He was 53. My father was Cherokee Indian, and a little man, and I do not mean this cruelly, but in more ways than one he was blind, and in more ways than one he was little. And I grew up afraid of him and hating him. At 47, giving birth to me and under such strenuous circumstances, my mother, his mind snapped. She never recovered from my birth. And the family, as denial is not restricted to alcoholics, and the family kept hoping she would get better. And at the age of 9 months, she did grievous bodily harm to me and was finally institutionalized. And she remained in the state mental hospital until I was in my adolescency. And with that, Bill sang something, "Closer, closer, nearer my God to thee," what? I don't know. I had that normal, average, happy childhood, as you can readily see. I was. I came from a good Christian home, which to us meant my father was Hardshell Baptist, and he was fanatically religious. And being Indian, he was very superstitious. And as a child, I had a lot of trouble separating if what I was doing was a sin or bad luck. You know, it was always a constant. It had to be one or the other. And I think in many cases, both. Because when my sins were found out, the bad luck was the punishment I got. My older brothers and sisters kind of dragged me up, and I learned early on the best way to get around Papa, and the common phrase was, "Don't get on Papa's nerves." You know. Looking back, in my sobriety, I come to understand that my mother, who was one of 11 children, both parents on my mother's side, both her parents had committed suicide. And of 11 children, only one of them lived their lives without being institutionalized. So a very well-adjusted group there. As I said, Mama was white, Papa was Cherokee, and Papa, while he never drank, was one of 18 children. Both parents, a step-parent, and most of his brothers and sisters drank themselves to death. So I say I come from a long line of drunk Indians and crazy poor white trash. And throw in the Hardshell Baptist, and you have got a winner. I mean, prime candidate for alcoholism. In our home, we were taught that it was a sin, an abomination in the sight of God, just like everything else I liked. But we didn't believe in doctors, and we had home remedies, and the basis for every home remedy was, you got it, white whiskey. You put Samson snake root in whiskey, and that's good for upset stomach. You put rock candy, hard rock candy, in white whiskey, and that's good for sore throat. You put lemon juice and sugar in white whiskey, and that'll break out the measles and the chicken pox. And I'm here to tell you, I was one sickly child. I learned early the first magic in my life was liquor. You know, as a child, I remember being cold and hungry so often. And in those North Georgia and North Carolina hills, I think most of my childhood memories were of being cold. And if I could feign illness, I got the home remedies. And God, it warmed me, you know. It filled that emptiness. I was no longer hungry. I was warm. And I loved the glow. I loved what it did for me as a small child. My preoccupation with alcohol went on to we played Indians and cowboys. You know, that was our slant on things. Depending on which side won, depending on which one we were. I would walk along the country dirt roads picking up Blatt's beer cans and liquor bottles, and I set up a saloon when I was 5. You know, I was a bartender. And that was my preponderance already. I was predisposed toward alcohol. As my brothers started coming home from various wars, they came home drinking, and I would steal their liquor, and I would go to their homes and drink. And by the time I think my first planned drunk, when I was 8 years old, a first cousin and I were walking to school one morning, and we found a pint of white whiskey on the side of the road, and we knew to shake it and check the bead, and it looked good. So we decided to go to Rabbit Branch and drink liquor instead of going to second grade, you know. This is, you know, do like the big boys. So my cousin took a few drinks and went home crying and very sick, and I stayed on Rabbit Branch and killed the pint. And the next day I stayed out of school to look for another one. My disease was off and running at 8 years old. By the time I was 10, 11, 12, I was having problems. We're Dry County. We had a local bootlegger, and all my older brothers had a charge account with him. And I could walk up to the bootleggers, and I knew what everybody drank, and I would get whatever their favorite and put it on their tab. Drunks pay their bootlegger, you know, and they don't keep a real close tab because they're in and out of blackouts, so I could get away with this. And I was buying liquor and charging it to my older brothers at the local bootlegger when I was 10 and 11, and by 12 I was expelled from school for being drunk. I drank my way through school. When I was, my eldest sister had left home to keep from raising me and returned home to give birth to a retarded child and left home again. And when I was 11, the child nearest my age was a girl, and she married. And I assured her that I could look after Papa and the retard, as I fondly referred to him. I had little names for him, like the mongoloid and the, you know, that baby, which is what Papa called him. I assured her I could look after this old blind man that I hated and this retard that I hated just as well. And so she left home. And a couple of months later, my oldest brother in a drunk went to Milledgeville to visit our mother and raise hell about the care she was getting. And they said, you signed her in. If you don't like it, you sign her out. So I came in from school that day and found I had my mother home. To this day, I had never called her Mama. I was terrified of the lady. So... that was my household as I went into my teens. I spent my time taking care of these three people, and I went to bed every night and prayed that when I got up the next morning they'd all be dead. And I would think things about torching the house, you know, while they slept. I had no compassion. A blind man, an insane lady who was bedridden, and a retarded child. And I had the only thing I could see is what they did to me, how they ruined my life, you know, how they affected me. And God, I hated them. And I was so into self-pity and it was my stock in trade, and that was my con that I ran. In school, if I was not doing my work, I would, you know, bring up the situation at home. If I didn't want to do what we were doing that day, I would say, I have to go home. They're sick. I took the nephew to school, and if there was a test that day that I didn't want to take, I would pour Fletcher's Castoria, which is a child's mild laxative, down him, a whole bottle, and would have to leave school to bring him home to clean him up. It worked. But I played. If you didn't feel sorry for me, when I got through, you did, you know. And it worked so well because I felt so sorry for me. For years, I said the best thing that ever happened in my life was Vietnam. It got me out of that. I went in service. I was brought home on emergency leave by the American Red Cross 3 times the first 6 months and was offered a hardship discharge, and I declined. I'd rather go to Vietnam than stay with these people on Royal Mountain. My insanity won, and I did. And I had a very illustrious military career. I conned my way into being the youngest first sergeant in the Air Force when I was 19 years old. I was first sergeant of a fighter interceptor detachment assigned to the Naval Air Station in Key West, Florida. And time and grade was waived to promote me. I was Airman of the Year for the Air Defense Command. And I had a terrific military career ahead of me, and I'd done this through giving people false ID cards, minors, myself got the first one, letting people drink in the compound, relaxing military rules. I had a little power. God forbid an alcoholic have some power. And I was able to use this and to manipulate. And so, you know, I had everyone's vote of confidence here. My drinking caught up with me, and it was either volunteer for Vietnam or be court-martialed. I took none. You know, who cared? I was going to die anyway. My first day in Vietnam, I learned better living through chemistry. I didn't have those toys. It's my last leave before going to Nam was the good old boys in Rockmart took me to the Legion Hall and bought me beer and told me what a great guy I was because I went down on 10th Street smoking pot. And I wasn't one of these hippies, you know, down there that was dodging the draft. I was a good old American red-blooded fighting man. Going to die for my country. Pour me another one. Then I got to Nam and met old friends that I had known stateside. I was introduced to a whole new concept of high. So it only enhanced the drinking. As I neared the end of my year in Nam, I found that I didn't want to come home because nobody there messed with me. Nobody cared. And I was free to drink, drug, do whatever I want, you know, as long as I could pull a trigger. And so I extended. Stayed another 6 months. When that was up, I went to extend again, and they put me on a scale, and I weighed 92 pounds, and they said, you're going to kill you before Charlie does. Go home. I came back stateside, finished my military career. I'd gone from one bad marriage earlier, and 6 days after I came home from Vietnam, I married again. I was 21, she was 30, and I had solved my problems. I had married the old maid daughter of the wealthiest family in our county. That's how we get ahead, the easier, softer way. I had everything I needed now. I had position. I had money. I had a nice home. And I had someone come up to me, the village idiot, and say, who were you before you married into the Jones family? You know, and I resented that, but then I'd rather be a Jones than a Locklear, you know, because I was so ashamed of who I was and where I came from. My disease progressed. I don't blame the end of relationships on my drinking, because it was relationships, had I been sane and sober, I would never gotten into. So I guess the divorces and the termination of the relationships are the same things I did. In 1973, I returned to Atlanta again to try to pick up the pieces, and it was a geographic cure. I'd had so many. And I started out in Buckhead and Roswell and drinking in the nice clubs where I had a membership card to get in. And within a year's time, I was down on Cleveland Avenue and Stewart Avenue and Campbellton Road where they frisked me at the door to see if I had a gun. You know, I'd come a long way, baby. I moved to Buford to isolate in 82 rather. I was sleeping under the bed with the windows nailed shut. I checked the mail after dark, and I left home only, A, I was drunk, or B, I was going to the liquor store. God worked in my life at that time. Our little hospital in Buford turned the maternity ward into an A&D unit. And the only soul I knew in Buford was the pastor of the Church of God who had been a former high school acquaintance. he had me sign a petition to get these drunks and junkies out of our community. We didn't know them. I signed his petition and checked into this treatment center. As Zorro, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And to this point, looking back where I came from, these very, very sick people from pitiful circumstances taught me the only way I knew to live. They taught me what they had been taught by drunks and by insane people. And they gave me a cold biscuit and sent me out in the world, and I didn't know what to do. I couldn't cope. I didn't know how to act. I didn't know who I was. And I just knew that I didn't fit in. I didn't belong. And I walked into AA, and I was introduced to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through them, somewhere, I started looking at me and finding out who I was, why, and how I came to be there. And I had the denial that I never hated my mother. I didn't blame her, and I learned that I hated my mother. I come to understand the hate I had for my father. He had died 7 months before I came into AA, and he lived and died without ever saying, "I love you." My brother nearest my age died while my mother was institutionalized, and she did not recall having given birth to me. And she called me Leon, which was my dead brother, until the day she died. And on the day of my father's death, July 4th, 1982, the self-pity had reached its climax. I was at the top of my self-pity. I had a mother who never called me by name, didn't remember giving birth to me, and a father who lived and died without having seen me or said, "I love you." And God, I felt sorry for me. That began my last binge, that self-pity, and it went on and on till I had worn it thin, and thank God my brother died December 7th, 1982, and that gave me another excuse to drink, and that lasted me till I walked through the doors of AA. When I started looking at me, and my fourth step and fifth step, when I was learning, finding out that I hated my mother for being crazy, for being old, for being helpless, not taking care of me, not preventing the physical, sexual abuse that I was subjected to in my home as a child. The terrible life I'd had, and I hated her. Mamas don't let their babies do that. And I didn't own that until I got to the fourth step. Shared it in the fifth step. You know, I owned those feelings I had for those people. Then in the steps, 8, 9, when I saw the harm that I had inflicted on these people because of my self-interest, the hate, the feelings I had for this retarded child, and how miserable I had made their lives, and how miserable I'd made my life primarily through my hate for them, and coming to forgive me and to forgive them, and working through that, and coming to understand my father loved me the only way he knew how. He was a victim of his circumstances. He was a victim of this disease. My mother, you know, there was nothing left but love and pity for that poor lady. And when I got here and you said, "We have for you a toolbox," my God, I'm left-handed. I can't drive a nail, you know, and Papa would say, "The boy's not stupid, he's just wrong-handed." And I was not allowed to use sharp objects, anything I could hurt myself or anybody else with. So the only tool I'd ever used was a hammer, because I could tear things up. I could break things. I could tear things down with a hammer. And that's the only tool I knew to use and the only way I knew to use it. And you said, "Here, we have tools for you, spiritual tools." And I thought, oh my God, I can't use tools. And someone said, "Here's a toy box. Build you something nice to play with." Uh-huh. The only toy I'd had as a kid was a yo. Does anybody know what a yo is? My sister and I saved up our money and went and got a store-bought toy, a yo-yo. And we had to split it, and she was bigger. She got the half with the string. It looked nice. It laid there. It didn't do a damn thing, but it was my toy. And had it not been for holes in my pockets, I would have had nothing else to play with. So I was given a tool chest, but I was given a toy box. I found a way to play, a way to laugh, a way to enjoy life. And it has only grown through my time in this fellowship, because today I have practiced with those spiritual tools. I know how to hold them. See, a telephone was a spiritual tool, and I'd never used it. I'd get drunk and make obscene phone calls. Did anybody else do that? No. Things that I learned to do with these tools, the things I learned to make, I built friendships with these tools, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Clearing away the wreckage of my past with these steps, I found out that it wasn't all bad. Among all that trash, that human wreckage, that wake of destruction, when I brought the house down around me, the Hugo that was in my life, that was me and my disease, and I started clearing it away, and I found not everything was destroyed. There were some things salvageable. There were treasures among the trash. They just needed cleaning up. They needed mending. And I have a place for them in my life today, and I treasure them. And I don't regret the past. I don't wish to close the door on it, because today I have so much from my past as a result of that horrible childhood that was inflicted upon me. You know, I thought for so long that God, when He was making me, was playing Mr. Potato Head. Does anybody remember Mr. Potato Head? You take the potato, you put in funny nose, eyes, you know, ears, and so forth, and God picked up this twisted little pitiful potato, and He put a big nose, big ears, bad teeth, and says, "Oh, hell, I'll go the whole way. I'll make him left-hand half-breed. I'll put him down there in that bunch of crazies." And, you know, this is... And I thought God did that to me. And maybe He did. But He said, "He's kind of cute. I'll give him a way out. I'm going to make him an alcoholic because I've given those people down there the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through that fellowship, he can have a happy, joyous, and free life." And that was it. The greatest thing that happened to me in my life to date is the fact that I was blessed with the disease of alcoholism. I have a way to live happy, joyous, free. I have a way to build on that foundation that I thought was so terrible, so tragic, so sad, so pitiable. And what I am building today is so beautiful, so splendid. And that's what these steps do. That's the magic in my life. That's the power. It's taken this poor little boy who didn't know what to do, didn't know where to go, could find no place he belonged. And today I'm one of you. I'm in a room of 300 winners, and I'm a winner too. Thank you. I love you.
I'm going to leave. I don't see a woman in the place. Y'all a bunch of ugly hardtails, I tell you that. I am Jimmy Smith, and I'm a very, very happy sober alcoholic. Hello, everybody. Amen. Clever as usual, I enjoyed it, honey, and I love you. I really do. This place, to me, is one of the greatest places there was on the face of the earth for lots of reasons. One of the biggest reasons, I guess, is because it's part of AA. My story's a little different from Cliff. My father was a doctor, and I didn't have any of those problems one way or the other. My problem was inside of me. All of my life, I felt uncomfortable. I felt ill at ease. I felt like I didn't fit wherever I belong. But I put up a good front. I would act like you wanted me to, and I'd act like I thought you wanted me to. But always, I had a hole in my belly, and the wind blew through, and I was full of fear and guilt and shame and remorse all the time. I never was happy with now. All my life, I looked forward to Friday. Something good's going to happen there. And then Friday would come, and it would happen. And then I would be sick of all of it. I would just be disappointed in it. And that's the way my life went until I found alcohol at 17 years old. My father was an alcoholic, and I swore I'd never be like my daddy. I wasn't going to drink liquor and embarrass my children and family. And I wasn't like him. I was thousands of times worse. But I never touched a drop until I went to college. And for the next 28 years, my life was a real mess. I'm standing up here now, probably one of the happiest two or three people on the face of the earth. I'm a former school teacher and football coach. And now I'm president of a bakery. And vice president, cook, and dishwasher, and delivery boy. I bake cakes in my kitchen, and I'm peddling them out on the street now. That's where I make my living. Well, my wife makes my living. That's where I get my spending money doing that, I guess, to be honest about it, is what it really amounts to. But for those 28 years of drinking, the first few years, alcohol relieved all of that fear and guilt and shame and remorse in me for a while. and I could feel just like you looked. I could go to these parties and these ball games, and I could go to class, and I felt on the inside like y'all looked to me. You know, I'm looking at your outsides with my inside. But mine was quick. Time I was 20 or 21 years old, alcohol started doing to me. It quit doing anything for me. I started getting in trouble. I couldn't do without it. The first time I ever drank in my life, I got drunk. And I had a blackout and had a hangover. In my opinion, I was born an alcoholic. I started drinking and I was off and running and booging and going on from there. But those 28 years, I've got to qualify myself pretty good here, I reckon. I was in jail, give or take, 5 times, somewhere around 200 times, give or take 5 or 10. I went to hospital 75 to 80 times, give or take 5 or 10. I went to prison one time. I went to 2 Christian homes for alcoholics, stayed in one of them a whole year. The judge sent me to a 28-day treatment program in South Georgia for a whole year. He said, if anybody needs it, I had DTs, convulsions, hallucinations. I was beat up by cops a lot of time. I was beaten up by inmates a lot of time. And people talking about the accommodations here, to me, this is kind of paradise. I slept on cement floors in jail for weeks at a time, and everybody come by, kick hell out of you and pee on you and everything else. The drunk in the jail laying on the floor, that's the lowest thing that ever was on the face of the earth. But now, I come to another thing. I didn't want to be a drunk. Did any of y'all grow up and say, I want to grow up and be an alcoholic, and I want to go to jails and hospitals and prisons and all that? No. You didn't want to be, I don't think. But I'm like Cliff. God gave us a way out. And to me, this is the greatest part of all that. I'd stand here and look you square in the eye, flat-footed, bare-faced, and guarantee you, but the program Alcoholics Anonymous works. No if, no and, no maybe. I can't pick out some of you and say it will, and some of you say it won't. The program is absolutely perfect. It works. And I'll guarantee you this. If you live and you keep coming to AA, you'll get sober. Sober, not dry. I'm coming back to that in a minute. But if you live and you keep coming, you'll get sober. I know some of us are sicker and some of us are thicker than others. It took me 10 full years of in and out like a yo-yo before I ever got 1 year. I picked up enough white chips to build a nice patio. Nobody ever said a word about it. They just kept loving me, and they kept loving me all through every bit of it. Any of y'all in here been before a judge? Don't worry, you're already, yeah. I know most of you have. You know, most judges feel like God went on vacation and left them in charge. I went before an awful lot of judges back in my time. But this old judge, he was really the most arrogant, egotistical so-and-so that ever lived. He had a poor soul on the front row. He just threw the book at him. And he was around back so proud of himself. He was around a robust gentleman. And a fly got the buzzing around his head. All around his head. And he was slapping and knocking at it. He got the bailiff up there to try to help him kill it and to tell him what it was. And he didn't know. And he got the sheriff up there. They didn't know what it was. And he was just all around his head. And they're all slapping at it. Little fella raised his hand and said, I know what it is, Your Honor. He said, you do? I said, what is it? He said, it's a Zuzu fly. He said, well, I never heard of a Zuzu fly. I said, what kind of fly is that? He said, oh, you know, Your Honor, the kind that always be buzzing around horses' asses. He said, are you trying to say that's what I am? He said, no, sir, Your Honor, but you don't fool them Zuzu flies. Oh. One. What are we doing right now? We're laughing. To me, that's half of AA, is the laughter. You go outside of an AA meeting any way you want to, and the meeting hadn't started, or most of the time when it has started, you're going to hear laughter. And you're going to look in, and you're going to see people having a good time. You're going to see people hugging and enjoying life. If we were all sitting in this meeting with this long, drawn face, who would want what we got? Nobody. They wouldn't want it. And I'm not taking anybody's inventory now, but I'm reading people's advertisements. I see some people have been around the program a while, and every time you see them, they got a long face. How are you that morning? I don't know. Well, what's... Isn't it a beautiful morning? What's so good about it, you know? They bitch, they moan, they complain, and I look at them and say, are you happy? Oh, yeah, I'm happy. I want to run up and grab them and they shake the fire. I'm going to say, tell your face about it. Let it know that you're happy, you know. Let it know. is the half of this program right here. People on the street ought to see us walking down the street and say, you know, there's something special about him over here. Say, he got that look. I don't care how long you've been in the program, a week or two or 3 weeks, you can look in people's faces and about tell who's got it and who hadn't got it. You can see that glow in the eye. You can see that peace and the joy and so on from it. Love comes a little bit later. But the laughter usually keeps us coming. Love helps us keep coming. Besides, most of us ain't got nowhere else to go when we get to AA. We ain't got another place in the world to go. But the love and the laughter makes it a little bit better. Now, dry. I mentioned dry a while ago. When I was coaching, I would be dry 6, 7, 8 months at a time. You know, we talked about the fear and the wind blowing through our belly and the shame and the guilt and remorse and all these things all the time. When I would be dry, I still had that. I just wasn't drinking liquor. And people always said, oh, Jimmy, just quit drinking liquor. You know, that's all you got to do. And I would quit for 6, 8, 9 months. I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to be what I was. But I was the most miserable human being on earth, trying to live without the alcohol. And I live in a dry county all during my drinking. Lincoln County, that's north of Augusta, was dry all my days. And after I'd been sober 3 years, they got together and voted it wet just for pure meanness. But see, I live 6 miles from the South Carolina line, and I told myself the second big lie over and over and over. Everybody knows what the first big lie is. You wake up in jail or in a ditch, you're hungover or beat up, and you say, God, I'll never do it again. You ever said that? Sure you have. And you mean it. That's the sad part about it, is at that time you mean it. The second big lie, I would tell myself, see, I'd push that first one on out the way. I said, well, I'm going to let that go. And I'd start across that river in the Carolina where there's a liquor store across the river. And I'd start across the river telling myself, I'm not going to mess up this time. You ever told yourself that? And I'd say, I'm going to buy a half a pint. And you can't get drunk on a half a pint. And I'd go buy a half a pint. And I'd come back and I'd take a drink before I ever got to the river. And I'd turn around and go back to the liquor store and buy all my money would buy. See, the first drink got me drunk. It took me years and years to learn that it wasn't the bottom of the jug. The very first drink got me drunk. And then I would be in trouble again. Then I would mess up again. If I promised you a while ago, but if you live and you keep coming, you'll get sober. I'm going to promise you something else. But if you live and you keep drinking, you'll do everything I've done. And that is an absolute guarantee promise. You'll go to all the jails and hospitals. You'll do all these other things. And I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a beer-aholic, a wine-aholic, a gin-aholic. I've been drunk weeks at a time on lemon extract. That's one of the best things in the world you can drink. That's 80% alcohol. If you could get rid of that ungodly lemon flavoring, you'd be in good shape. Good shape. My last few years, that was my drink of choice, was lemon extract. You have no driver's license, no way to get anything. You drink what you can. I've been drunk for weeks on Minim's aftershave. Green Lizard is the common drunk name for Minim's aftershave. All the half tonic, anything that's got alcohol in it. The maddest my wife ever got at me, some company gave her a little bottle of perfume that cost $100, and I drank it one night. The worst thing about that, the next 3 or 4 days, both ends were just awful. Just awful. When I would be dry, I would accumulate a few things, and I'd get on a drunk, and I'd go across the river over there and swap a $75 rod and reel for a $5 quarter whiskey, $30 and $40 knives for a pint of whiskey. I'd go to bootleggers in another county. My bootleggers in my county wouldn't sell me anything. They all thought I was crazy. They figured I'd call the law back, the preachers back with me or whatever. But I was begging the bootlegger to let me have a half pint of shine liquor on credit. 50 cents. 50 cents, and I didn't have 50 cents. But I was begging him, please let me have a half pint on credit. And he looked down and said, I like your shoes. I said, oh, come on, man, let me have a half pint of shine on credit. I like your shoes. And I walked off in my sock feet for a half pint of shine liquor. I once swapped my boat, motor, and trailer for a case of beer. Somebody's sitting here now saying, I'd never do that. That old fool did it. Please, please, do not fool yourself. If you live and you keep drinking, you will do it. I've been in jails and hospitals with people that tell me that I would never do such a thing as that. 2 or 3 years later, I'll be with them again. Yeah, I did. Because, see, you run out of money. You run out of friends. You don't have a telephone. You don't have a car. You don't have anything. I was born and reared in Lincoln. I was a football hero coach in Lincoln. And I turned to the town drunk in less than a year's time. And I'd beg people on the street, stop them, wave them down, beg them for a quarter, 50 cents, anything to get a drink. I'd go in my neighbor's homes, and I'd steal the liquor if they had any. If they didn't have any liquor, I'd drink whatever they had, the extracts, the halftime, anything they had in the house with alcohol in it. And I'd go in the stores at home, knowing they're looking at me, and take a bottle of lemon extract off the shelf because I had to have it. I was going to die without it, and thank God they didn't say anything and didn't put me in jail for that. Although I went to jail many, many times. I went before the judge in my hometown, and all my friends that I grew up with and played ball with in court, sitting there looking at the drunk. That's humiliation. That's shame. All the way down. But alcohol was first. I would have do any of that. I would live through any of that to get my alcohol, to have my alcohol. During my periods of dryness, as I told you a while ago, people patting me on the back and put their arm around me saying, Jimmy, you're doing great. So you're looking good. But they couldn't see my insides. They couldn't see the torment that I was in all of the time. Never, ever did I have a peaceful, happy moment from the time I took my first drink till I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I love to talk about now, is how sweet it is to get sober. I get so tickled talking about it, I don't know what to do. And I get so excited at these things that I just can't hardly sleep because of it. Because see, the dry is the misery. When you work the 12 steps, the 12th step says what? Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these old 11 steps. Didn't say nothing about maybe. Didn't say nothing about it can. It didn't say nothing about probably. It said having had. Positive. It has happened because you worked these over 11 steps. That's when you get your peace and your joy and your happiness and serenity. Say, I used to come to in a jail. Strange jail. Scared to death. Because I didn't know what jail I was in. And I didn't know why I was there. And I didn't know anything about it. I think it's Tuesday and it might be Thursday of the next week. I lost lots of times, 2 and 3 weeks in blackouts. And you wake up like that with that horrible fear and just running all over you. And I woke up in hospital strapped down a lot of times, your arms and your legs and a band across your belly, messed all over myself. And I woke up in the woods an awful lot. Again, I had messed all over myself and ants and spiders be crawling all over me. But I don't do that now. I get so tickled every morning I wake up to two miracles. I wake up in my own bed sober. And I lie there and just grin all over. I get so tickled at it. Because I am sober. And I am free. Free! This drunk, this jailbird, this gutter drunk is free. I can get up and go to the bathroom. Don't ask nobody. I can lay there and scratch whatever's itching. I don't have no problem with that. And I don't need a drink. That to me is the greatest part of all. I don't need a drink. I don't wonder where my truck is. I don't wonder what I got into last night. I wake up free. And that happiness and peace and joy. Getting to do this, that's what I told you last night, to be grateful. The attitude of gratitude to me is the greatest thing ever was in the world. When you are so thankful for it, and it grows, and it grows, and it grows. All of it grows. If you don't have a good measure of happiness and you've been around a little while, please do the steps again. If you got a bunch of happiness, please do them anyhow. Stay on the steps all the time. That's the key. That is the whole basis for all of it, is the steps to work them, to keep it going. And they told me, Tommy O'Hill, my sponsor, he said some things all through the years that's helped me a lot, but he and all the other sponsors I had, some of them have died, said, Jimmy, the more you give, the more you get back. And I didn't know what they were talking about. Giving? Giving what? You know, give yourself. Give your time. Give your love. Give your care. And it comes back more than you can ever imagine how much you get back. And I didn't know, but I didn't know enough to know anything, so I tried to do what they told me the best I could. And it slowly cleared up and slowly came along, and it does get better. And I've been sober about 5 years. I've been sober 10 years, 5 months, and 14 days now. And after I've been sober about 5 years, I got where I could think a little bit. See, I was diagnosed as a wet brain. Doctors, psychiatrists, many of them told my wife that he'll never stay sober. He hadn't got sense enough. He's damaged his brain so bad, but you got to just lock him up and put him away. And thank God she didn't believe it, and thank God people in AA didn't believe it. Because they just kept loving me and kept loving me. And Tom and all the other people in my group that literally loved me sober. And until I could learn to love myself and I could get sense enough to work on the steps a little bit. But I've been sober about 5 years, and I just told my wife, I said, it can't get any better than this. I just don't believe it's possible to get any better. But the next year was better, and the next year was better, and I know that next year's going to be better than this if I do what I'm supposed to do. Again, I go back and say, we have to do something. If I don't drink, and I go to meetings, and I work my steps, and I do what I'm asked to do in AA. When I get a call from AA, to me, that's God calling. He's on the other end of the line down there, and I don't have any choice about a lot of things. A lot of times, you know, all of us are lazy. I'd like to throw my feet up and look at the ball game or something. But if the phone's on the other end, it's pertaining to AA, I don't have a decision to make. That's my feeling. I get up and I go. Because I know I'm going to get a lot more than I give. A lot more than I give. It's just the most amazing thing in the world to get the attitude of gratitude to get out of ourselves and start trying to help somebody else. I'm known as being a happy person and a kind of outgoing person, but I get blue. Heavens, I got Al-Anon to live with, so you know I get blue. I can't help it. And I got two Al-Anons, whatever they are. I don't know. I'm glad they won't hear this tape either. I got two sons that are alcoholics, but they don't drink. They never drank in their life, but in my opinion, they're just as much alcoholic as most people. They are non-happy people. They're alcoholic. Personality, attitude. And I told my wife, I wish they'd go get drunk a few times where I could get them in the program, you know. But they don't want nothing to do with the program or me, either one way or the other. And my wife, she still wants to pinch me every once in a while, you know. I mean, I've been broke a long time. And she keeps trying to wanting to fix me all along the way, and I have to live with that. But I can stop and think where I was. I can stop and think how it used to be. And I can remember the jails, and I can remember the humiliation and shame I went through. And I get so happy I can't hardly stand it because it starts coming back again. But also, the main thing I have to do is come see you people. I have to live with you people. A few weeks, a few months ago, I was kind of down, and I couldn't figure out why I was kind of down. And it was bugging me, and I was praying about it, and I was sitting there saying, God, I'm sorry I'm down. And I don't know why I'm down, as much as you've done for me, but yet I'm down. And I got a call from a friend in Atlanta. And she said, Jimmy, what's wrong? I said, what do you mean, what's wrong? She said, something's wrong with you. And I hadn't talked to her in months. And we talked a few minutes, and it dawned on me. I hadn't been but to two AA meetings in 2 weeks. And that hadn't happened to me for over 10 years. But circumstances had set it that way. I went to a meeting that night, and I felt a lot better. I went to one the next night, and the next night, I felt fine again. I normally go to 4, 5, 6 a week. And I take that. People in my hometown don't know nothing about AA one way or the other. They know what I was and know what I am now, so they're all for AA. But they don't know what it is. They still ask me, say, Jimmy, you still go to them classes? I say, yeah, I still go to them classes, you know, one way or the other on that part. But a fella asked me a few years ago, he said, Jimmy, do you have to go as much as you do go? I said, I don't know whether I have to or not, but I ain't going to find out. Said, I know they're all tanked, if you know. If I don't go to meetings like I'm supposed to, I know they're all tanked. But going to the meeting is not going to help. You got to participate. If you're on a big old raft out in the middle of the ocean and sharks all around you, you ain't going to get up on and hang around on the edge of the raft. Because you'd be afraid one of them reach up and grab you and snatch you in there and eat you. Or something might bite you or might get you. You'd get right over in the middle of the raft, wouldn't you? Sure you would, because you don't want to fall off. You don't want to get in the ocean. Do the same thing with AA. Do the same thing with the 12 steps. Jump in the middle of it. If you'll get in the middle of it, you get involved, you get active, you get busy, you're not going to fall off. You're not going to fall off if you get over here in the middle of it and you sincerely, conscientiously work on your steps, do service work, do anything you're asked to do, and do it happily. We're the most blessed people on earth. I wouldn't swap who I am or what I am or where I am with anybody. And these nuts running around out here, so-called earth people, most of them crazy as a bat. And they don't know why. We're crazy and know why. And we know what's wrong with us. But the good thing about it, we know what to do about it. We're in the right place to get it changed, to turn our lives around completely. I enjoy every minute of my life now. I don't anticipate ball games. I don't anticipate this. I don't anticipate that. Sometimes it's a nice thought, but I enjoy now. That to me is one of the other great blessings of it, is I enjoy being alive and living. See, alcohol ain't my problem whatsoever. Alcoholism is my problem. And it ain't alcoholism. It's alcoholism, and it's going to always be there. And I've always got the doctor on it. And I hear some people say, well, I have to go to a meeting tonight. I've got to slap the fire out of it. Be glad you're going to a meeting tonight. Go because you want to go. Want to go to meetings. I know at the beginning you feel like you might have to go, but when it turns into I want to go to the meeting because I feel better, because I'm going to maybe help somebody else make them feel better, which is in turn going to make me feel better. If we don't admit it, it's still there. The more we give, the more we try to help others, the more we are going to get out of it. Am I all right on my time? Huh? All right. But the point is, please, don't let me get anything across. Let me get this across. You are not special. You are not different. You are not too dumb for this program. And you sure as hell ain't too smart for it. You're certainly not too smart for it. Most problems in this program are from the highly intelligent, from the highly educated. They are the ones that struggle the most. And you're not unique. But you don't understand. Boy, I don't understand. All of us don't understand. Because you're not, again, special, unique. You're drunk. You're an alcoholic, however you want to put it. But you're in the right spot. And AA will work for you. You can't say, but I do this, I do that. Somebody has done it. All of us in here, somebody has done it. You're not special. You're not unique. You're not different. And the program Alcoholics Anonymous, not one single word is out of place. Not one single word. Bill H., that just died, was a friend of Bill W.'s. And he said, if you could change any part of how it works, and it hadn't been changed a word for 50 years. He said, would you change anything? He said, I might change. Rarely have I seen a person fail to never have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I get so excited and I get so tickled and I get so grateful and sometimes I feel like I'm going to bust. And it's here for you too. I'm not any different from anybody in this room. None whatsoever. So you can have exactly how much effort you put into it, how much desire you put into working the steps to make it work for you. And please, don't let anything keep you from coming back. Don't let your pride, don't let your ego, don't let shame, don't let family, wife, children, doctor, don't let nothing keep you from coming back to AA. Because it's here for you and it's the greatest thing that ever was on the face of the earth. I really and truly feel sorry for outsiders, but they can't come here and enjoy what we have. My young preacher at home goes with me to my birthdays and he's been with me several times to hear me speak. And he says, y'all got the greatest outfit that ever was in the world. He makes the statement of a lot of preachers, if the churches had what we have, what a wonderful world it would be. Because we love each other, we care about each other, we try to help each other. And if you're wrong, I tell you you're wrong. And if I feel like you're goofing off, I tell you that. And if I feel like you need a kick in the butt, I'll do that too. That's what it's all about, is sharing and caring. Please, make the most of this weekend. It's the greatest thing ever was for me, and I thank God for Dr. Handel and all these other people that got this thing started and that I was able to come and participate a little bit, but mainly to come and be here to enjoy it. I love all of you with all my heart and soul. Thank you so much.
I certainly enjoyed the low-key presentation of Jimmy, and he's got me enthused. I never knew that about Cliff. I knew he was goofy, but I didn't know it was his folks' fault. You hear that, Glenn? I'm much better than you thought. My son's here. You know, I'm Bill Roop. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be here. And as I listen to people share the miracles that have happened in their life, Jimmy got here with a doctor and family, and Cliff got there with his problems, and I got here with mine. But one thing I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not important what got you here. Whatever it is that got you here is valid. But I don't have to be the same person I was when I came in here. I can no longer blame outside circumstances or my wife or my father or my mother with what I've done today, because Alcoholics Anonymous is a miracle program that by sharing with other people where you've come from and what's happened with the grace of God in your life, you can do and be anything you want to be sober. You got to pay prices. Jimmy talked about the schooling, and Alcoholics Anonymous has been one of the greatest schools that I've ever attended. I've had the privilege of attending other schools, and a lot of the things I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous I've learned before I came here. But one thing about Alcoholics Anonymous and people that are working the program, they don't learn the program, they live the program. They keep talking about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are very important. But the big book does not start out with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The big book starts out with two alcoholics sharing what's happened to them. And then a third alcoholic showed up, and he shared what happened to him. And that's why when you're in the big book, and I always suggest that although the steps are very important, get into the whole big book. It starts out with Bill Wilson talking about what happened as we're talking here today, this our story. Then it talks about there is a way out. Then it talks about more about alcoholism. Then it talks about this is a spiritual program. We're going to talk about God. And then finally it gets into the how it works. So I always suggest that make sure you, if you're in the 12 steps, and a lot of people that go to institutions are told to get in the 12 steps, and I'm always very amazed with them because they're there 28 days and they've taken a fourth and fifth step and they figure that's probably the end of it, you know. It takes a while for me to get to know what I was. I'll tell you briefly where I came from. I was, my mother died when I was young. My father allowed me to be raised by another woman, so I felt inadequate. I felt I wasn't loved, and I didn't like myself. So therefore, I lied and told people some story that would make me look better. This is before I drank. So I was a liar before I drank. I also was trying to buy friendship, so I used to take money from the church when I was very young and walk across the street and buy candy and give it out to my little friends. I was trying to buy friendship because I figured they really wouldn't like me if they knew me, but if I could buy them, they'd like me. So I was a liar and a thief and a dreamer and a person that was inadequate. Yet if you had seen me in these days, these formative days, and when I was in high school, I played on basketball team and I was very active in athletics, and I became president of the Baptist Young People's Union of my church and the council for the city of Chicago. I was on the surface, I assumed that I looked all right, but inside I felt that if you knew me, you wouldn't like me. I felt inadequate. And this was long before I drank, so I can't blame these character defects on my drinking. I don't think drinking had anything to do with my character defects. Some of the things that I did when I was crazy, I found out I'm capable of doing sober. I brought Bill Roop to Alcoholics Anonymous. As Jimmy said, I was very blessed. Our whole family's been blessed. We're going to have three generations of Roops here today, but Tommy, my grandson, decided he'd rather puff snuff Scotch guards than come to this group, but I'm sure he's very unhappy about it. But you can't get something because you want it. It's got to be because you feel you need it. And if you do, then you get the benefit. My son Glenn is here. This is his... He's got coming up on 10 years of sobriety. So we're blessed with the disease of alcoholism. We didn't know him when my wife and I, my wife's an alcoholic too. When we got married, we didn't know we were an alcoholic. We were two people that met down at a bank. I became attracted to her and asked her to go out on a date, and we ended up married. We didn't drink. When I went overseas, I didn't drink till I got to England. And I remember on the invasion of France when I came up to the top of a hill, scared and dehydrated, a Frenchman came running over, a farmer, and gave me a bottle of, I thought, water, and it was Calvados, and I chug-lugged the whole thing, and I don't think I drew a real sober breath from there until I got back home. So although drink was not immediately a part of my life, lying, cheating, stealing, feeling of inadequacy and inferiority, drink made me unable to live my fantasies. Drink was the answer. When I came back from overseas, my wife, and this is an amazing thing, some of you don't know this, but I went overseas for a couple of years. When I came back, I was an alcoholic. My wife didn't go overseas. She stayed home and she became an alcoholic. So you don't have to go overseas to become an alcoholic. You can get it right here in the States. But I tell a friend from Germany, so he thinks that's what a Germany to get an alcoholic. Oh, incidentally, I want to mention one thing. Jimmy is great on hugs. I used to think he was the greatest guy in hugs. You want to get a hug, get a hold of this guy from Germany. Now, when you do it, make sure you protect yourself, because that some bitch will break your back, you know. He may be a sober alcoholic, but he's mean. You know. So I came back from overseas, and before I left, my wife and I had a daughter named Peggy, and she went to live with my mother-in-law in a one-bedroom kitchenette living room apartment. When I got back from overseas, I moved in with them. There's no place to go, so it was my mother-in-law, myself, my daughter Peggy, and my wife. Then I went to a Catholic university, and I'm Baptist. And at the end of my first year in a Catholic university, there was my mother-in-law, my wife, my daughter Peggy, and my son John, and my wife and I in the one bedroom. And then at the end of the second year, there was my mother-in-law, my wife and I, and my daughter Peggy, my son John, and my son Richard in a one bedroom apartment. And at the end of the third year, there was my mother-in-law, my wife, myself, my daughter Peggy, my son John, my son Bill in a one bedroom apartment. The place was getting gamey. But if you hang around those Catholics, you get a lot of kids, I'll tell you that. Now, we were happy in this one bedroom apartment, at least I was, because we were drinking. When you're drinking, you can stand near anything. And I was out telling lies and being doing whatever it was, arguing with the Jesuits, you know. One thing I learned at Loyola University, if any of you are Catholic and run around with Jesuits, I learned from the Jesuit what sworn to poverty means. That means that you're going to buy, because they never have any money, you know. So if you run around with Jesuits, plan on paying, you know. So I learned that at Loyola. My wife... I graduated from college and we moved out to Park Forest and we lived in a nicer home now, three bedroom, and lost a mother-in-law, gained another kid, my son Glenn came along, and nothing changed really. We just found more bars to go to. We were in the same soup. I still felt inadequate. I didn't feel I could make it. See, I came here a loser, because anything I did in life, I played on championship basketball teams, but I felt if I did it, it really wasn't anything. But if I was somebody else, then you'd be impressed. But anything I've done, I never felt it was important, because if I did it, it meant nothing. So anyway, I'll give you a story or two about drinking. My wife and I, Bill or Wes was talking about, I had different careers. I remember one time I was in Blue Island and I was drinking and I was starting to head back to Park Forest on a summer day. And as I started driving out of Blue Island, a fellow cut in front of me in his car, and I rolled down the window. He had the windows rolled down. It was summertime. And I suggested that his driving was inadequate and that he shouldn't have cut in front of me. And then I suggested his ancestry was suspect. And he had a few words to say to me, too, you know. And I told him I finally had enough of his shit. And I said, look, we're going to call a cop and get this settled. Well, he was a cop. And I ended up in a Blue Island jail. Now, I started yelling that I was an officer of the court. I was a lawyer incarcerated for trying to stop mayhem on the highway. Got so bad the judge came down and released me on personal recognizance. I want to tell you right now, I'm only a lawyer when I drink. But I want to mention that, because a lot of times I forget to tell you that, and a lot of people come up and want legal problems. But I always solve them. In fact, if you have medical problems, you can come and see me. No sense seeing the doctors, I'll tell you how to do it. I found out that lack of knowledge of my topics has never stopped me from talking, and that's an all over. So I've got to sweat out, because I got to go before the judge, and I'm afraid he's going to find out I'm not a lawyer. And geez, I'm an Allstate agent sitting on a little stool in Blue Island in the Sears store. Everybody walking by, you know. And anyway, when the time finally came to come to court, I went there and I was the last case called. And when I walked up, the judge said to me, Your Honor, Counselor, how do you feel? Geez, I felt great. He hadn't found out I was a liar. You know, he still thought I was a lawyer. So I said, I'm real sorry the way I conducted myself in your presence the last time I saw you, but the fellow was wrong on the way he was driving. He says, well, I think everybody's calmed down. Why don't we forget it? So if you get drunk in Blue Island, be a lawyer. It'll probably get you out. Another time, my wife and I were out drinking, and it was 10:30 at night in the Dawn Club, and I was elected to go over and get a pizza in Chicago Heights. They have wonderful pizza. So I went over to get this pizza, and I'm driving down the road, and all of a sudden, I'm surrounded by cops. And so this one cop is telling me, get out of the car. And he wanted me to get out of the car on the side that he wanted. Well, I couldn't open a door on that side for a variety of reasons, so I slid over to the other side. When I started to get up, I looked up, and in Chicago, the police carry a little leather strap with a lead weight in the end. And if you take that thing and flick it, you can break picnic tables with it. We used to do that. We had relatives on the force, and we'd take these little things and whack and break the picnic table. This guy was going to use it on me, and so I ducked, and he hit the top of the car, and I came up under his nose. I got him right on the Adam's apple. See, I'd been trained in hand-to-hand combat in World War II, and I'd never really seen this work. The 6-foot cop was laying there just boom, boom. I'm looking at him. I can't believe it. And but see, I tried this in bars. Some guy'd get tough, and I'd go, yeah, and I'd give him a chop, and then he'd go, whoom! But when they drove me back to Park Forest, because at that time, the way they tested to see if you were inebriated was you put your fingers together, and if you could do that, you weren't drunk. And if you walked the line, you weren't drunk. So I was good at fingers together and line walking, so I wasn't drunk. So the cop that had made a mistake, he made another mistake. He drove my car. And as he was driving into 26th Street, I'm told, he's going about 45 miles an hour, came up to a red light, put on the brake, and went right through. See, my car worked, but you had to build up the pressure. The window on my car worked too, but you had to tap it. And if you wanted the windshield wipers, you'd reach out one like this in the rain. You know. So my car worked, but you just hadn't know how to do it. The reason my car wasn't doing so good, I still had the 5 kids, I still was a drunk, I was selling insurance, but I couldn't afford to buy it. But I afford to drink and tell lies and be somebody out in the bar. So now they're taking me back from the jail, and they're going to release me because I'm not drunk. The good cop, this guy's friend, is driving me. Now, being a lawyer, I knew that I couldn't be tried twice for the same crime. It's unconstitutional. So I shared this with the cop. He said, I would have sworn you were drunk. I said, I've been drinking all day and all night. But I said, I passed the test, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it because you can't be. He said, he didn't say anything. Right in the middle of my soliloquy, he put handcuffs on me. And now I'm in the Chicago Heights jail. Now, there's no sense being a lawyer in the Chicago Heights jail. They don't pay attention to lawyers. Chicago Heights is run by the mafia. It's a nice Italian community. It's still up there. It's a very nice, peaceful community. But they have a mafia. Sometimes he's a mayor of the town, but whatever he is, he runs things. And I knew that. So I was in the jail. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm yelling, I'm one of this guy's boys. So at 2:30 in the morning, they wake him up, and they say, we got a guy named Bill Roop over here. He says he's one of your men. And the guy tells him, release him. You know, you can't lock up fellows that are in the hoods. You know, you don't lock them up for no reason. So not only did they let me go, but they brought my car back. They'd impounded it. They brought my car back. And I drive back to the Dawn Club, and as I walk in there, 2:30 in the morning, I open the door, I walk in, and my wife and everybody else says, where's the pizza? And the great thing I like about alcoholics, they weren't in the audience of life. They were on the stage. They were doing things. You're my type of people. Very few of you people, if you're up here talking, you'd all have your own story to tell. You weren't sitting back wondering where life was going. You were out there lighting fires, you know, and getting things going. Well, my wife and I were having so much fun that I came in Alcoholics Anonymous January 3rd, 1957. Woke up on the floor of a girl's house, and she said to me, you know, I said, what was that number you called? She joined AA. I didn't really know what it was, but somehow, what's that number you called? So she gave me the number. I'd been drunk for 3 days. I went home and slept for 3 hours, and 2 guys showed up. One guy shook his head like this, and I figured, he's nuts. Have you ever had a guy come in your house just sitting down? I figured, he's goofy. And the other guy worked in the steel mills, telling me I used to hide bottles in his locker at the steel mills. And I figured, geez, now I got to hang around with Polacks in the steel mills. I should never have made that phone call, you know. Now, the reason I did that is because the last years of my drinking, I looked down on everybody. See, when you're nothing, I elevated myself by putting you down. if I met Einstein and Einstein said everything right, and then I asked him the time and it was 3 o'clock, and he says 1 minute after, I'd say, see, he can't even tell time. I'd find something to elevate me and put you down. When I came in AA, I was still that type of guy. The fact that I called two guys didn't change my life. What it did is lead me to a program that changed my life. They took me to a meeting. Some guy like me was up there talking. Didn't pay much attention. Looked like the Baptist church on Wednesday night. Kids running around drinking coffee. If you want that, you can get it. And I figure when this is over, I'm leaving. But a fella came up to me and said, can I drive you home? Now, this guy played cards with the President of the United States. He was also knew the senator from Illinois and played cards with him. He also knew the governor of the state. He was a friend of Mayor Daley. He's more my type of guy than these two balls. So when this guy took me out to my country estate, I was living in an estate in the country at that time because I'd been evicted for non-payment of rent in part forced. And when he took me home and we got out of the car, he said, I'd like to have you come to a Friday night, Homewood 17. It's a closed meeting of AA. And I explained to him I owned a company and I wouldn't have time to. I've got to get things going in the ball. He told me in profanity, Yankee profanity, what I was. And not only did he tell me that, which got my attention, he smoked cigars and he kept jabbing me and I'm ducking him, you know. And finally I started laughing. I said, I'll go. And I was exposed to the greatest fellowship of men and women I've ever met in my life, Alcoholics Anonymous. Miracle Land, USA, was given to me that night. Now, a lot of the things they were saying was a little weird. Like they talk incessantly about not drinking. Well, that was a little strange. A nice guy, but why were they talking so much about not drinking? See, my wife and I had never thought of not drinking. Drink is the only thing that made life palatable. You got 5 kids, no dough, and people are after you. Reality sucks. If you're drinking, it ain't bad. You know, everything's okay. So drink kept me alive the last 2 or 3 years because my life was terrible. I was ducking people, hiding. I felt no good. I felt I was a failure. I wasn't good for my... I wasn't a good father. I wasn't a good husband. I wasn't a good worker. I wasn't responsible. But if I drank, who cared? Tomorrow I'll take care of it. See? So I come in this outfit and they say, if you don't, can you... So a guy comes up to me and he says, can you stay away from a drink for 24 hours? And I said, sure. But why would you want to do that? And he said, because based on our experience, if you do that, your life will get better. So that's why I'm here. My life sucked. If I don't take a drink, my life's going to get better. Now, I'm real happy they didn't tell me how long it was going to take, because I don't know if I'd have stuck around, you know. So I got exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. You notice I haven't said anything about the big book or the steps or anything. Homewood 17, the group I came in with, I'm sure they had a big book. I don't know where it was. I spoke at the International in 85. And my sponsor was there, and I said, Jack, did we have a big book in Homewood 17? He says, yeah, it was on the card table, and it was dusty. Now, that's sacrilege today to talk like that, isn't it? When the steps are the way. I tell you, it doesn't start out with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It starts out with the love and fellowship of one drunk for another. I came to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lying, cheating, irresponsible, no-good son of a bitch. I put the cork in a jug, and now I was a sober, lying, cheating, and so forth. Nothing had changed. When they exposed me to these concepts, these people walked the big book. These guys lived the life of the big book. It wasn't an intellectual exercise. They lived it, and that's what they shared with me. They'd say, how was your day? I'd say, rotten, and this no good rotten guy did this and this. He'd say, boy, you like to stay sick, don't you? What do you mean? You don't understand. This guy did. He said, I don't care what he did. I said, well, what could I do about it? He says, you got to pray for him. Pray for him? That rotten guy, I got to pray for him? He says, only as long as you want to stay sick. You want to stay sick, don't pray for him. So they showed me how to walk. I was not happy. I'm going to give you a few examples of what life was like when I came in. From the moment I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been 12-stepping people. I didn't want any part of God. Didn't want to hear anything about God. God, I had divorced myself from God. And yet in the other book, the Bible, it says, whatever you do for the least of me, you do for me. So I wasn't wanting God, but I was doing God's work. I was working with people from the very beginning. Not good people, not nice people. People that threw up in my shoes, that type of people. People I don't want to be around. Anybody that loves a drinking drunk, you have my sympathy. Some of these drunks I worked with were real jerks. Now, today, they're wonderful guys. God had me work with people, not because they were good people, but because they were drunks. Homewood 17 didn't love me because I was a wonderful guy. They loved me because I was an alcoholic trying to stay sober. When I came into the program, they had a I remember one time after a few months, I came up to my sponsor and I said, Jack, I'm not going to make this program. He said, why? I said, I'm kiting checks. I'm doing the same crap I always did. He said, wait a second. Did you have a drink? I said, no, I didn't have a drink. You see, gentlemen, I've never had the urge to take a drink from the day I walked in AA. And I used to be drunk once or twice a week and drank every day. I didn't know it was a miracle. I didn't know God had removed it. I figured all you guys did that because I was from my own experience. So I said, what's the big thing about me not drinking? He said, let me tell you. He says, out of the millions of alcoholics that are coming in, only about maybe 10% of them are going to get to AA. And out of the 10% that get here, maybe only half of them are going to get sober. You're one of the guys that's an alcoholic who's staying sober. You're a miracle. And every night when you go to bed and you haven't had a drink, you're a winner. And Jack Murray was one of my, that's the guy with the big car that I admired because I could relate to him. He made me feel that I was a winner. See, I was a loser when I came here. I was plugged into negativity and I was happier with negativity and I'd screw it around until it would be negative. They wouldn't let me be negative. Another time they were talking, this one guy told me, he says, why don't you turn your life over to the care of God? I said, that's ridiculous. I don't have an anthropomorphic concept of a God who's up there pulling strings. He gave me free. He said, oh, shut up. He said, I've been watching you for 2 years. He said, you could turn your life over to the garbage man. He'd do better than you're doing. And I said, okay, wise guy, how do you do it? He says, you turn over to God whatever's bothering you. So I used to say, hey, God, we're going to repossess the car. Hey, God, there's no food in the house. Hey, God, we need this. And you know what I was doing? I was praying. All my God wants me to do is talk to Him where I am. If I'm in a good spiritual position, talk to Him there. If I'm in the pits, talk to Him there. My God loves me if I'm on a high or on a low. God is not the problem. I learned here, I'm the problem. Now, after I finally started plugging into God, I started plugging into God at that time. But I used to plug into God in this manner. It was touched on the other night. But I would plug into God like my electric light lamp is plugged into the wall. It's always plugged into electricity. But the light bulb's not always turned on. See? So I'd be driving down the street with God and I'd say, hey God, I'm going into this whorehouse. Wait out in the car and I'll be right back. See? Now, I never went to a whorehouse. That's not been the things I've normally done, but Wes was sharing this with me earlier. So, he'll mind me sharing this. And but you see, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, we all got our whorehouses. If I'm cheating on my income tax, I don't say, God, hey, let's sit down and cheat on the income tax. Or if I'm going to cheat on my wife, or I don't say, hey, wife, you know, God, let's go do this together. Although He's with me, I don't say, God, let's go do it. Say. I found out that if I'm going to stay plugged into God, I've got to stay plugged into God. When I plug into Bill Roop, I get full of anger, jealousy, fear, resentments. I'm scared. I'm not going to make it. I'm a commissioned salesman. Jesus, I don't even know where I got. I am scared. Plugged into God. I got a can-do God. He can do anything. I'm plugged in. He loves me. He wishes me well. He's given me things to do that I've learned here. If I follow and trust Him, things are going. I don't have any fear. So today I try to stay plugged in. Now, to give you a practical example, how do I know when I'm unplugged from God? When you start looking funny. When I walk into a room and I always think, yeah, look at that guy's hair. He can afford $40 haircuts. You know, look at this guy, got a Mercedes. When you start looking funny, I'm unplugged from God. I'm back in the Bill Roop. But if I walk in and feel good about you, geez, I'm happy I'm here, I'm plugged into God. See, I can tell real easy. Now, the practicality of it is, I'll give you an example of the other night. I came home from a trip. My wife, for some reason, was feeling very insecure. She's an alcoholic, been 30 years in the program. And when she gets insecure, she starts talking to me and talking to me and talking to me and talking to me. Geez, I'm tired. My neck's aching. I've had a long trip. I've got some problems I got to do. And she's talking. We're finally in bed. It's 11 o'clock. She's sitting on the bed. We're talking. And I'm figuring, because I've been running around with God all this time, I can't hit her anymore. So I figure, I'm going to get out of this bed and go get a motel room and get some sleep. Okay? And then it comes into my mind, why don't you plug into God? And I do. I plug into God. And immediately, I start thinking, gee, Jan's probably had a bad day. I love this girl after all she's done for me. Boy, I wish her well. I'll listen. Nothing changed except my attitude changed. And it wasn't me that did it. See, in one of the steps, it says, Humbly ask God to remove these defects of character. Try to do all you can with your defects. But it says humbly ask God. So when I'm getting into self again, how dare she do I. If I plug into God, then it becomes, hey, how can I help you? How can I be of help to you? How can I give to you? And then I'm not sick. So when I came on the program, I'll tell you one little bit about honesty, because a lot of people know that I have a reputation for rigorous honesty in this program. And I'd like to share it with you. But I made a 12-step call with an airline pilot on a guy that was drinking quite badly, and we finally got him talked, his wife taking him back. And as we're sitting there, the airline pilot says to the pigeon, he says, Henry, the men are in AA, the heroes are in AA, the kids and the cowards are out there drinking. He says, for example, he points to me, he says, this guy's got the Congressional Medal of Honor. Well, I don't have the Congressional Medal of Honor, but I didn't want to mention it in front of the pigeon. We've been talking about honesty. It would have confused him, you know. So I've always been considerate. And when we got outside, I forgot to tell Tom about it, you know, and he went to a Thursday night meeting I used to go to. I quit going to that for some reason. And, you know, how many people here are under a year? Raise your hands. Okay, you know that we tell you that we're honest, so you can believe us, right? I got 32 and a half. You certainly can believe me. So, at your peril, you know. But, so Tom had 3 years. So they all believed Tom. Tom said, Bill's got the Congressional Medal of Honor. I saw it and that sort of thing. And so everybody would come up to me, or a few of them would come up and say, Bill, I understand you had quite a war record. And I'd tell them, I just assume not talk about it. And, and I got a reputation of being a humble hero. And then finally a Yankee girl came up to me and she said, Bill, what's this Congressional Medal of Honor bullshit? And I said, I don't have it. But let me tell you, fellas, I had it 6 months in AA, and that's longer than most of you had it, I'll tell you. These years, it was 7 years like this. These years, you notice I still haven't said anything about the steps. I got transferred to Atlanta. Oh, I got into the steps this way, piecemeal, which was, you got to take the steps however you can take them. If you're in an institution, it's 1 through 12. I go to step meetings now, 1 through 12. I don't have any trouble. God put it in that, great. But when I came in, my mind was fragmented. I couldn't do this one. The second step didn't apply to me. I'll give you an example of that. My son's here, Glenn, didn't apply to me. I wasn't nuts when I came in. A lot of them were, but I obviously wasn't. 30 minutes, that's too long. Oh, sorry. So my son, after I was sober 10 years, my son was a heroin addict. He was emaciated. He was running out. He was carrying a gun, going down Hunter Street, getting drugs. He was driving my wife and I absolutely nuts. He was driving us apart. My wife said, do something about it. I said, I'm turning it over to God. She says, that's a cop-out, and we were going to get a divorce. It got so bad that at this one particular night that I grabbed Glenn, and Glenn was daring me to do something, and I took him to bedroom, and I was going to kill my kid. And before I did, God wouldn't let me, and I walked out of the room. I don't have any problem that, does the second step apply when you're drinking? Maybe. But it applies to me when I'm sober. When Bill Roop is plugged into Bill Roop, he's capable of simplistic answers. If I'm plugged into God, I love my kid. Now, let me, in closing, tell you the benefits I've got by plugging into God. I've got four sons and a daughter. My son Glenn is an Alcoholics Anonymous. He's plugged into the spiritual on his own. He's got a wife and a kid that's very healthy and happy. They got a family life. They can compete in life. They can be a part of. He's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. I've got a wife that knows herself better. She's an alcoholic than she ever could have known herself. She's plugged into God. She's plugged in exactly what this program said. She has progressed to where it's not her doing it, it's God and us doing it. God through you people. My daughter has gone through things. She's plugged into spirit. Our family is together. It's not fragmented. My son Tom can't be here, but we love him. We don't hate him. We don't feel he's less than adequate. He's an alcoholic, and he's screwing up, which is not too unusual for an alcoholic to do. But today, the love I've got here is expressed in my family. It's expressed throughout my life. That's what it did, the healing power of love. In closing, I want to tell you something I heard down here in Atlanta. Alcoholics Anonymous may not open the gates of heaven and let you in, but it'll sure open the gates of hell and let you out. And every morning when you wake up, the devil casts a vote for a hell of a day. And God casts a vote for a heavenly day. You cast a deciding vote. You're the one that decides whether you want to have a good day or a bad day. But let me tell you one thing. If you're an alcoholic, and if you cast a vote for a bad day, but if you go to bed that night and you haven't had a drink, remember, you're a winner, and God loves you. Thank you.